This episode of the Startup Slingshot is brought to you by Sunag Consulting. Sunag Consulting offers services to help your business compete and succeed in today's marketplace, including website design and online marketing. You can check them out at sunagconsulting.com or contact them by phone at 615-669-3269. For all the loyal TSS viewers out there, Sunag Consulting has put together a PDF of 20 things you can do today to improve your Facebook fan page. To snag a copy, click the Sunag logo to the right of the video. Now onto the show.
My name is William Griggs, founder of the Startup Slingshot, a resource that delivers guidance from experienced entrepreneurs and business experts on how to dream, launch, and grow your business. Do you have the goal of starting a business but can't seem to take the first step? Today's guest is Dan Ariely. Dan is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University and the author of two New York Times bestsellers, including Predictably Irrational and The Upside of Irrationality. Today, I'm going to talk with Dan about how you can use the results from his research to motivate yourself to start. Enjoy. All right, Dan, take two. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. I've been looking for this for now 3 weeks. I can't imagine. It's finally the day I get to share some thoughts with you. I'm excited, thrilled. I'm just hoping I will be able to contain my enthusiasm in the next few minutes we have to spend together.
I know, and our viewers have been looking forward for us to getting together and recording this interview for quite some time as well.
Very good.
Yeah, so tell our viewers a little bit about your background for those that might have been living in a cave for the last couple of years.
Well, so my name is Dan Ariely, and officially I'm the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University, and I do research on what's called behavioral economics. And behavioral economics is basically kind of the ugly stepchild of economics. And if you want, in economic theory, we think that people are always rational, reasonable, they can view all the options, they have no impatience, no emotion, they always make the right decisions. In behavioral economics, we don't have this positive view of human nature. We think that people are more like Homer Simpson. People are myopic and vindictive. People have all kinds of mistakes, all kinds of heuristic shortcomings. And because of that, the implications for how you want to design society and the implication of how you want to design institutions, and most importantly for us, what kind of software and tools you want to give people are very different. So, for example, imagine how you would create financial savings if you thought people are perfectly rational versus how would you create financial savings for irrational people? Or how would you create phones for perfectly rational people versus for optimally designed people? And once you understand the exact ways in which people are irrational, then you can actually think about how you help them. And I think this is actually, for me, the biggest kind of intersection between behavioral economics and entrepreneurship, is that when you think about what do people need, I think people need mental crutches. So in the physical world, we design a lot of things to overcome our limitations. You know, if we were all like Superman, we would not need light and we would not need heat and we would not need steps and we would not need speakers and all of those things. So what do? We spend a tremendous amount of our life devising and creating tools to overcome some of our physical limitations. And I think we do this because our physical limitations stare us in the face. We can't think that we can jump higher or project our voice louder, or, you know, when we drive, we have to recognize the amount of mistakes we make because we see people dead on the sides of the road and we see accidents. But with mental problems, think about things related to healthcare, financial reasoning, all of those, we don't get the same evidence about our mistakes. They don't stare us in the face in the same way. And because of that, we don't necessarily recognize the amount of mistakes. And I think this is where new products and new ideas could actually become very important. So think about the financial crisis, right? Was the financial crisis caused by a bunch of uber rational people who were making the right decisions all the time? Or was it caused by systematic flawed individuals who made systematically flawed decisions? And now you can start thinking about what would you create in order to regulate these mistakes.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So I kind of want to take this interview and kind of break it down into two parts. Because again, the goal here at the Startup Slingshot is to help people act on their dreams of becoming an entrepreneur or launching their own business. So I kind of want to break it down into two sections now that we have this great overview. and talk about kind of mental crutches that we can focus on helping our viewers or our listeners with regards to helping them act. And the second is helping me. How can I best structure the Startup Slingshot, the website, the material to help them get the most out of it? And then again, with the long-term goal or even short-term goal of getting them to act. So let's start with our viewers. What are some mental crutches or mechanisms they can use to help them get started and overcome the issues?
So, first of all, let me say something very fundamental about entrepreneurs, is that if you went ahead and did the cost-benefit analysis, it's not clear to me that many people become entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are taking tremendous risks in their effort, and they're not really maximizing always the cost and benefit. What they're maximizing are other things, like the need for accomplishment and achievement, the desire for a better, more meaningful workplace. I mean, the sense of creating things yourself. So it's not clear to me that if people only did the cost-benefit analysis, many people would become entrepreneurs. And in some sense, I think we have to salute and recognize the irrationality of entrepreneurs for giving us this wonderful world, because it's from lots of people trying and many of them failing that eventually we get lots of progress. Think about something simple like restaurants. Lots and lots of restaurants fail. I think that if you just did a cost-benefit analysis, nobody would, the risk is not worth it, so nobody would open a restaurant. But how would you like to live in a city when nobody opened a restaurant? It would be terrible. So in some sense, it's the irrationality of entrepreneurs that is actually propelling the system forward. I remember a Dilbert cartoon where Dilbert bought the first fax machine. And he said, now all I need to do is to wait for another person to buy a fax machine and we can start discussing. And Dogbert was saying how sad it is that the progression of human species depends on people like you. But that's exactly the case. So I think entrepreneurs should not think of themselves as rational people. If they were rational, they would do something else. In terms of getting going, I think lots of people have an idea of what they want to do. And there's kind of two basic problems. One is a problem of motivation propelling you forward and how do you do it. And the other one is deciding when to stop and figure out this is not worth it. So let's think about each of those things. There's lots of things in startups that are fun and exciting. It's really nice to sit in coffee shops and talk to people about ideas and talk how the world is going to look like 20 years from now, when this startup is worth $1 billion and so on and so forth. And there's lots of very tedious things like going over contracts and talking to lawyers and creating IP and writing code. I mean, and some of those things are tedious and boring. And the question is, how do we get a mixture? Because if you think that a startup is just a fun game, and this is, of course, not the right case. So one of the things we know is that it's all about scheduling. It's all about regimented ideas about how to get work done. So B.F. Skinner, one of the most famous psychologists of, you know, the last, actually forever, had a system in which he would go to the office and he would not do anything else until he wrote 800 words. This was his Achilles heel. This was something that was difficult for him. He decided he was going to attack it first. He gave himself a rule and he followed that rule religiously. I think the same thing is important for people in startups, is to take the tasks that are not as fun, break them into small components, and create a regiment of how much you're going to do of that every day. And what's interesting is if you do it, you realize how much work you can get done with small chunks. So think about writing 800 words a day. It sounds trivial. 800 words a day, that's not that much. But an average book has 80,000 words. So it means that if you actually did that every day, you would basically finish 3 books a year, or 3.5 books a year, which is a feat that is incredibly hard to accomplish. But what happens is if you have a rule of 800 words a day, there's a good chance you'll get progress. If you don't have a rule, you might wait a week and don't do anything, and then one day do 1,000 words. But at the total, the progress will be much lower. So I think we need to acknowledge the boring part, space it out, and be regimented about it. The second problem is the problem of sunk cost. So entrepreneurs have ideas, they have directions within the ideas, how should we direct it? And the problem is that once you've invested a lot of effort in one direction, it is hard to change your mind and say, let's go in another direction. In one of my books, I described this as the not invented here idea. And the not invented here idea is that once you develop an idea, you think it's yours, you fall in love with it, you've invested some energy and effort into it, you fall in love, you don't want to change. And one of the saddest examples of this was Thomas Edison, who was an amazing inventor. He invented the direct current, among other things. And one of his engineers, called Tesla, invented the alternating current. And he developed it under Edison's time in Edison's lab. Edison could have had the rights for alternating current, but Edison hated this competitor to his idea. So he basically fired Tesla. And not only did he fire him, he was trying to fight him. He hired a PR company to try and defame Tesla. He funded the creation of the first electrical chair using electrical alternating current in order to show how dangerous it is. And indeed, it was dangerous, right? There's lots of ways in which alternating current is very dangerous. Every time there was an accident, he would take this accident and make it into as much a PR nightmare for alternating current as he could. You know, he was an amazing inventor who fell in love with his own invention, and that kind of made him blinded to the fact that there was something else potentially much better for many other solutions, much more able to take scale into account, and he was just not able to accept it. So that's the second challenge, is when your idea is not going the way you wanted, when direction you thought is not the right direction, how do you give up? And the problem here is kind of acceleration of commitment, is that once you start doing something, if you don't have a rule for that, and here rules are good too, where you could say, I'm going to try this direction for 4 months, and if by April 20th this is not working out well, I'm going to change my direction, or basically have some milestones, but be very explicit about it. So I think that both of those cases, both the kind of the motivational aspect and the stopping rule aspect, are about creating a very detailed action plan. And what we know is that once you have an action plan on paper, there's a good chance that you would stick to it, even if it's only what's called cheap talk, even if you don't sign a contract with a lawyer and you don't have to do it up front. But the moment it's written there, there's a good chance you would obey by it. So for me, I think those are kind of the challenges for entrepreneurs that would be interesting to kind of try to figure out how to tame them to some degree.
Gotcha. Makes a lot of sense. So create that detailed action plan when you're thinking about, again, the scheduling of tasks. So any entrepreneur or any business owner that starts out, there is this big chunk of stuff they don't want to do but need to do, and this big chunk of stuff, like you're saying, that they want to do and they have fun doing and gets them excited. But to make progress, you need to do some from each bucket. So like you're saying, take the less fun tasks, break them down day by day. You'll make progress, but you'll also be able to get through it, because you're not going to have prolonged agony tackling it for multiple hours at one time, instead little chunks day over day. And then the second you talked about was sunk cost, which was interesting, because you say you put a lot of effort in one direction and you fall in love with your idea, but you didn't set a rule or set any form of metrics, that explicit milestones that in the future, if it wasn't to a certain point, you would kill it, or you would move on to the next, or you get a day job. So that's an interesting point. Anything else you want to talk about?
And here is one way to think about sunk cost, which is often hard. But so imagine the two cases. In case one, you've invested $5 million in pursuing an idea, and the odds of it succeeding at this point looks like 15%. You've invested $10 million, the odds of success looks like 15%. And the question is, would you invest another $1 million to figure out if it will work or not work? That's case number one. Case number two, you invested nothing, and there's an idea that you think has 15% of working, and you can invest $1 million to figure out if it will work or not work. How would you feel about both of those ideas? You know, most of when people look at the first one, they say, well, I invested 10 million already, I might as well invest the last million to figure it out. Whereas if you didn't invest the initial 10 million, you would say, is it worthwhile to spend $1 million on an idea that has a 15% chance of success? Probably not. And this is the sunk cost problem, fallacy, and what's called, you know, throwing good money after bad. So the question is, how do we detach ourselves from our past investments? And it's very, very hard to do. But if at each point you could say, let me just look at things going forward and try to the best of your ability to ignore the past investment, this would lead to better decisions. And I'll tell you, by the way, I have a dangerous version of this question. So three of my friends in the past have asked me about whether they should stay married or not. These are all three guys, and the only three guys that asked me for my opinion. And in all of those cases, I asked them, if you were not married today and you knew everything you know about this woman, would you propose today? Would you want to get married, right? So forget the fact that you're married, that this is about the past. The question is, if you knew everything you knew today, would you want to get married or not? And, you know, sadly, in all cases, people said no, and therefore they followed the conclusion and got divorced. But I'm not kind of recommending that people start thinking about this every day about their married life. But I think in general, if you think about it, there's lots of stuff that we do because this is what we've done before, and it's good to kind of disassociate ourselves from time to time from those past decisions and say, how do we want to live moving forward?
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Anything else in terms of the motivation side of things?
So there's lots to talk about motivation. And, you know, we started by talking about the fact that entrepreneurs' motivation are usually not about financial motivation because we couldn't really explain that behavior very well in terms of financial items. So now the question is how the entrepreneur is going to be motivated, largely because it's their idea, like Edison, right? I came up with something, I love it, I think it's wonderful, I'm connected to it. Now the question is, how do you get other people on your team to care as much as well? And this is kind of an interesting conflict, because if you take full credit for your idea and you remind everybody every day that this is actually your idea and they're just working for there and how wonderful you are and this is your idea and you came up with it and you're in charge, how much of people's internal motivation are you going to be able to recruit? Well, not that much. But if you could share the credit, if you could give people the idea that this is part of theirs and you can get people to contribute and add, and the contribution would not be as clear, right? So we can have a situation in which we all contribute and it's not really clear who exactly did what and we don't do bean counting about who proposed what. All of a sudden, those things can actually be better, because now by sharing the credit, you also share the motivation. So I think entrepreneurs have the kind of desire to be the maverick individual who came up with the idea, is the founder, the most important person in the company, the genius. But this could be hampering other people's motivation to join and be as caring.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So share the credits, kind of the takeaway there, because like you're saying, even though it may be our idea, we can't push it as just solely our idea, because we're going to need people with complementary skills or people to support us along the path. What else can we cover? What else can we learn?
For entrepreneurs. So, you know, the truth is that if you think about entrepreneurship and you ask what is different about entrepreneurship, entrepreneurship is basically doing business with other people's money. I mean, starting small. The differences between that and big companies are not fundamental to kind of human nature. However, there are some benefits of entrepreneurship, and these are some of the benefits come from the fact that they usually start small. So if you think about it, one of the things we know least in business is about how to motivate people. If you looked at every company, there's probably not a single company that their biggest line item is not salaries. But if you ask the question of how do salaries translate to motivation and performance, the answer is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is that companies early on set rules for how they're going to compensate people, and they basically follow those rules. And there are no variants, right? There are very few companies that say, hey, let's do an experiment. Let's pay these people this way and this people that way and see which one works better. So because there's no experiments and because there's no natural variation, it is very hard to actually learn anything about how compensation works. And also companies don't change it. I mean, if you went to a big company, Eli Lilly right now, and you try to change the compensation scheme, it would be incredibly hard to do. People are kind of committed to their past. There's all kinds of contracts. It's very hard to do. But if you think about compensation structure as the main way to motivate people, then you want to think early on about what kind of tools are you going to create? What kind of contracts do you want to have? And we have a couple of interesting examples for this. So one of them is, of course, Google. So when Google came around, they had this idea of giving people 20% of their time to do whatever they wanted. And you can think about what's the value of that. So first of all, in retrospect, we can ask, the fact that you could do 20% of the time on your own, what does it create to the social fabric of the company? And what does it do to people's motivation in the other 80%? But in Google's case, we can see that it actually came up with lots of innovations. So people don't go swimming in this time, and they don't go eat and drink, even though there's lots of free drink and food. But instead, they actually produce all kinds of interesting things that are not, or at least were not, in the main line of the company for a while, but became important projects. A very different approach was taken by Zappos. So Zappos have this interesting approach where they take people who are coming to the training to become, you know, customer service representatives. And after a week or 10 days of training, they say to themselves, thank you very much for coming. We would love for you to be part of the Zappos family. But if this is not enough for you, this is not the right thing for you, we'll give you $2,000 to decide not to show up. And you have 48 hours to decide about that. Now, this sounds like a crazy strategy, right? Why would they do that? Well, let's think about it. If you're in a company like Google, and you have an ideology around search, freeing information, allowing people, blah, 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 you can get people to be motivated around the main concept. You can get people to motivate about the ideology of the company. If you're selling shoes, it's a little harder, right? It's a little harder to get people to get excited every morning. Today, I'm going to sell some more shoes to relatively affluent people. I mean, it's just not the same inherent motivation. So what Zappos is trying to do is they're trying to create external motivation that are not inherent to their product, but inherent to the culture of the company. So maybe people are not excited about shoes, but they're excited about Zappos. And from that perspective, this paying people not to show up is actually very important. Why? Because first of all, you have a distribution, people who want to be there and people who want to be there less. And by giving some people, everybody who wants to, you give them money to not show up, you basically are taking advantage of this distribution. You're basically eliminating the people who really don't want to be there. And those people would, A, not be good customer service representative, but they might also poison other people. So that's the first advantage of this. The second advantage is, imagine that you had this offer and you turn it down and you show up to work at Zappos. And now every morning you wake up and you ask yourself, why did I turn this down? And there's this interesting idea called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is the idea that if we believe one thing but act in a different way, we believe one thing but act differently, this causes an uncomfortable situation. This causes a dissonance. So what do? We can't change what we've done. What we've done, there's no avoiding it. So we change our opinions. So you wake up in the morning and you say, why did I give up $2,000 when I could have stayed at home sleeping for two more weeks for this amount of money? And you say to yourself, well, if I did that, it must have been a correct decision. Why did I do it? It's probably because I really love Zappos. And now the people who've given it up over time probably get even more and more committed. And indeed, Zappos has a very loyal, almost cult-like, a work environment, which I think at the end of the day is benefiting everybody. The employees are happier and the management is happier. So the point, I guess, is that thinking about compensation in a broad sense, thinking about motivation, thinking about money, thinking about a sense of accomplishment, a sense of competition, a sense of belonging, community, all of those things are part of the global picture of motivation. And there's no better time to think about what is going to be the motivational mix of the company as in the beginning. Because once you set it up, it's hard to change. I think it's worthwhile thinking upfront about it.
Yeah, so any specific things we can do? Obviously, you give some good examples of Google and Zappos and the types of things they've been doing. Do you have any recommendations of what we could do maybe if we start at the very beginning to get us thinking about this?
So first of all, it depends on the company, and it depends on whether you can offer internal motivation or external motivation. So if you're a company that is doing medical devices, you know, it would be nice to spend some effort showing people the relationship between what they're doing and the people that are saving their lives, right? That would be the internal motivation. And you can have pictures of those people, you can have information about them, you can talk to doctors, you can do all kinds of things with an eye of saying, what do I do to give people a sense of the mission of this company? And then if you don't have a sense of mission, because, you know, the company is, you know, I don't want to offend anybody, but, you know, you're doing something that has no inherent internal value or little internal, you're selling average quality wine, right? You can convince yourself, oh, I'm selling a better quality for cheaper price, but it's hard to kind of argue that you're changing the world in any meaningful way. Now you're trying to create other aspects of motivation, things about team, things that are kind of internal to the company. Now, in all cases, it's good to develop both of them, right? The more motivation you develop, the better off you are, but the focus should be different depending on the company. And then there's another thing which I think, and again, this is something that is difficult to check, but I think that the creation of bonuses is actually quite destructive to motivation. So ask yourself, how much would you like to create a work environment in which in October, November, and December, people talk continuously about bonuses, and that's all they're concerned, that you create this evaluation method, and everybody evaluates everybody else, and everybody gets a point system, and it's between 10 and 16, and for each quarter of a point, they get another $250. How much would you like to be in a work environment that is continuously occupied and preoccupied with who is getting exactly how much money? I think those are kind of some of the basic things to think about. So if it was me, I would try to write an equation. I would say we have motivation, and we try to get motivation to be high. And then we say, what are the things that lead to motivation? A sense of progress and achievement and money and happiness and loyalty and teamwork and desire to please and so on and so forth. And you write all of those things. And by the way, lots of them can come from games, right? Gamers are really experts in motivating people without paying them. And then you write to yourself, once you have all the list of all of those things down, you say, which one of those I can use in my company and how would I use them? And that for me would be kind of the starting point.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's some good advice right there. It makes a lot of sense to break it down even to that formula, like you're saying, motivation equals, and you have all your variables that you could, and then you factor in, if you say motivation, you want motivation 100%, and then you factor in each progress or money or achievement or teamwork or community or other perks, free lunches, that'd be great. All sorts of stuff that you could factor into that formula, like you're saying. That's a really good point that hits it on the head. Any other things we could think about if we're starting at the very beginning in terms of helping us motivate our people?
Any other things that... So nothing comes to mind right now in kind of as a general point.
What about motivating us just to get started?
Yeah, so I think... So you know, it depends on which case we're talking about, but... You know, I'm imagining somebody who wants to get started, has an idea, but other things in life are pressing. So they need to do something else with their other job, right? I'm imagining somebody who's not quit their job, somebody who's doing this as a part-time to try and figure out whether this would work, this would work out. So, you know, I'm not an entrepreneur personally, but my own example for this is writing books. So in my day job, I'm a university professor, and I have lots of things to do as a university professor. And then I wanted to write a general audience book. And first of all, it's hard to start. How do you get going? And then how do you find time? Because other things become more pressing, and other things have deadlines. So, you know, students want to meet me, and they have exams, and I don't have enough time in the day to do my first job. When would I have enough time to do my my second job or my entrepreneurship activity. And going back to the first topic we talked about, I created a rule for myself. So with my first book, I had a rule that after 11 p.m., I don't work on university stuff, and I only work on the book. And that worked for a while. And with the second book, I had a rule that I only work on those things on the weekends and not during the weekday. But this separation and having a strict rule and keeping it as a strict rule was helpful. Because the problem is that, let's say one time I have hundreds of papers to grade for my students and I don't finish by 11, I can say, oh, why don't I keep tonight? I'll work until 2 a.m. on the class-related stuff because otherwise I'll miss the deadline. If you use this approach and you try to use a rule to kind of regiment yourself into action, you can't break the rule. It's important to adhere to it because if you break it once, the odds are that you keep on breaking it. The other thing is that other people motivate us to a large degree. So professors often say that one of the best way to learn something is to explain it to other people. And I think it's because the moment something is just in our minds, we think we understand it, but we actually don't. And once we articulate it and try to explain it, we understand how little we understood it from the get-go, what is missing. And there's all kind of interesting exercises about this. But from that perspective, I think it's also very valuable to find a partner. So early on, it's very tempting to do things alone, but I think a partner could do both of those things. They could force us to into some articulation that would be more precise and more useful. Right, when we leave things in our own minds, they could be a bit more vague and less precise, and we can make all kind of illogical jumps in them. But when we're forced to face somebody else, we might not do it to the same degree. And the second thing is they create a barrier. I'm not they create a barrier for procrastination. I'm not a biblical scholar, but in the Jewish version of the Bible, it says that God created Eve as help against Adam. So it has both of these words of both help and against him. And the question is, what is help against? What does that mean? And I don't think this is the category for women in general, but I think this is the kind of a relationship you want with partners, that they are both providing some help, but also some opposition in the same degree, because you want the kinks to be worked out before you get to funders and before you get to the market rather than after.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So you started talking about getting started. To help us get started, we create that rule and we don't break it. Like you're saying, with your rule, you had it originally 11 p.m. on. You'd work on your first book, and then you thought that wouldn't work for the second one for some reason, and then you changed it to the weekends. But you stuck to the rule. And that seems like something that's difficult, like you're saying, for people. Okay, I got this time. I got this, you know, this deadline coming up, and I have a time crunch. Instead of sticking to the rule, often people will just move the rule, say, oh, I'll just quit working at 10 tomorrow. But like you're saying, we just keep breaking the rule to where, you know, if we had worked ahead of time, knowing that our rule would not change, we would have gotten our work done, as opposed to knowing.
Or maybe not, and maybe you would miss a deadline, but you just accept it. I mean, this, by the way, is one of the challenges of what's called work-life balance, which I haven't figured out myself, so I'm not an expert on this. But when you think about work-life balance, there's always work has these deadlines and things to do, and family home usually doesn't have deadlines in the same way. So it could be that your daughter has a, you know, ballet recital, and that's one thing, but the deadlines in family life are not on the same gravity, not in the same precision, and the dependency of the flexibility seems to be much higher. So what do? We focus on the more explicit, measurable deadlines, and we sacrifice the things that are not. So if you think about not work-life balance, but you think about work-entrepreneurship balance, you have the same problem, that work has demands, and then demands, you know, 24 hours of work is not going to be sufficient. But what you need to do is you need to think about it as if you're creating deadlines, because the nature of the activity, like the nature of the family, is not going to create the same deadlines for you as work is going to create. You don't have a boss in the same way. They don't get mad at you in the same way. The other people don't depend on you in exactly the same way for whatever day you're going to finish something. So I think with this understanding of this inherent imbalance in the force between work and life or work and entrepreneurship, we need to think about how we fix that.
Gotcha. So the work-work balance is what we'll call this. Just make some notes. The work-work balance, that's an interesting point of saying, you know, maybe if at your day job they say you have to do this by Thursday, you actually have an equally as hard set deadline for your own entrepreneurial endeavors or outside work.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And then the other, we talked about finding a partner that could be, like you're saying, a barrier for procrastination or someone that could help bounce ideas or can like poke holes, like you're saying. If I feel like I really get it, but I haven't explained it to you, and then I try to explain it to you and I just completely botch it, and you're like, what are you talking about? That's just a great exercise to find your own holes in your idea that you can work on and work out before, like you're saying, you go to raise money. So, you know, so far in this interview, we kind of talked about how we as individuals can get started and set rules and motivate ourselves. And then we talked about how teams or how we can motivate our teams, you know, sharing the idea and incentivizing them in different ways. What about things I can do with the Startup Slingshot? Ways I can structure the website? Can I, you know, I'm just making up stuff as I go. Can I make up challenges to say, hey, you know, what's your rule or anything off the top of your head? I'm struggling.
So again, think about the notion of motivation. Right? How do you get people involved? What really motivates people? So, of course, people like ego. There's almost no limit to our ability to fall in love with ourselves and our own ability. And that's why so many websites that give people badges are so successful, because they basically flatter people's egos. So imagine that you wanted people to give you suggestions, and you wanted to increase the quality and the quantity of the suggestions. What would you do in a way that would increase people's ego motivation to help you out? So I think this is something we can learn from open source software. If you think about the big advance of open source software was actually a legal advance. It was the fact that they basically agreed that once somebody is creating something, from that day on, their name is always going to be associated with that. So there was some permanency. So I create something, and I don't get paid for it, but in some universe, you know, everybody who is using it is kind of using me, and I'm benefiting them. And that's kind of a tremendous pride of ownership. One of the students at MIT when I was there did an interesting study. He basically created three types of discussion groups. He asked people to give suggestions about how the UN can achieve something. It was something to do with the US-UN relationship at the time. And he either paid people for an idea, per idea, piecemeal pay. He either paid them for their time, or he paid them only if other people build on their idea. Right? Think about it. Now, all of a sudden, you're getting to do something, and you don't get direct benefit from it until other people are building on that idea. And I actually paid for his experiment, and the third condition basically almost killed the whole budget that I gave him for this. Because once people got fed by, you know, first generation and second generation and third generation responses, they were much more motivated. And the same thing happens with bloggers, right? People write blogs because they hope somebody would respond, and people play on Farmville because somebody might come and visit, and all of those things. It's about the reaction that we get from people, and this is incredibly important for us. So when you think about engagement, I think the question is, how do you give people some permanency of the value that they've created, something like open source software is given, or how do you give people the ability to have kids, in a sense, that are like ideas? You know, people are in love with their kids. They think that their kids are the best, the smartest. They pay a tremendous amount of time and effort and energy and money to their kids. We're clearly overly excited with our kids. We are biased. We think that they are wonderful, and of course they are. But to other people, they don't look as wonderful, and that's a problem in itself. But if you say, let me try to motivate people to think about ideas and contribution as kids, then you want to build this relationship and ownership ownership and permanency and allow other people to build on it and so on, that would be kind of one direction.
Gotcha. So ownership and permanency, like you're talking about. So when they contribute an idea, their name is associated with it. And they're not just, I'm not just taking their ideas and running with them.
That's right. And you allow other people to build on it as well. So that even enhances the level by which it's their idea.
Gotcha. So what else? What are some other ideas as I continue to write down all your thoughts?
So, you know, I saw your website when you first wrote me. I haven't looked at it recently. But the question is, what are you trying to achieve, right? Are you trying to achieve, you want more people to come? Do you want the people who come to read more information? Do you want people to click more, to register more? So I'll give you one last kind of very general idea. And this is an idea that in some sense everybody knows it exists, but the magnitude, I think, is astonishing. And this is about defaults. And the default is the idea that the path of least resistance is much more tempting and has a much higher success of being executed about. And it also means that small bumps in the road, small things that are creating friction, could actually matter to a very, very high degree. So there's a company called Express Script. It's a wonderful company. They do all kinds of interesting experiments. And one of the things that they do is they send people their medications online, in the mail. Sorry, they send people medication in the mail. You need some cholesterol-reducing medication. Every 90 days, they send you your medication in the mail. And what they try to do is to try to get people to move from branded medications to generics, right? And they send people a letter and they say, please, please, please move from generic to branded. You will save money, we will save money, your employer will save money. Everybody would be happy. And what do people do when they get these letters or pre-addressed postcards or something? Nothing. Very few people are interested. So they try to offer people low copays. What happened now? Nothing again. Right? So when you look at this data, you would say people hate generics. They just don't want it. No matter what discount you give them, they basically don't want it. However, if you thought about this setup, it is hard to separate how much people don't want generics versus how much people hate responding to any kind of opening an envelope and responding or returning a pre-addressed postcard. Now, I don't mean hate, but you know, it's one thing when you ask people, would you return this postcard if you could save $40 a month for the rest of your life? People would say, yes, of course. But when it comes in the rest of the junk mail and you put it in a different pile, do people get to act on it in the same way? So one of the things they came up with, it was a forced choice decision. So think about it. In the current setup, people were going around their way. They were just doing nothing. They were going along the path of least resistance. And Express Group was coming to them and saying, please do something different. Please do something different. Please do something different. And people said, basically, no, we're continuing in our path. So the method they came up with was saying, let's force people to a T-intersection. And the idea there was to say to people, look, buddy, you can't not return this postcard. If you don't return this postcard, your medication would stop. But when you return it, you can choose generic or branded. It's your choice, but there's no way for you not to return the postcard. So now this resistance to a small bump in the road was not relevant anymore. Almost everybody switched to generic. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us that small bumps in the road, while they might look insignificant, are actually quite significant, right? Something that is a click away is actually much larger away than you think, and things that you could get to be automated and as systematic as an opt-out rather than opt-in, all of those things would help to a tremendous degree. And I'll just say this as a final point, is that I think we have a lot to learn from computer hackers. So computer hackers take a system and they analyze it in very detailed view and they say, let me see exactly what is the flow of information, how it progresses, and then let me think about where I could attack, what could I do differently, what tools do I have. And I think we can think about human nature and the interaction of human and computers in the same way, or people in their environment. When we analyze the things that we do, what do we do when we're in line for the supermarket, when we buy a sandwich, what do we do when we're on the website, and so on. And for each of those things, about where are weak points and how could we attack these weak points and how do we take these little bumps in the road and make them go away or less significant. And by doing this detailed analysis, I think we can get much further.
Yeah, so that's a great place to end, like you said, and I really appreciate your time. Where can people find you online?
So my website is called danarielly.com, D-A-N, Arielly is A-R-I-E-L-Y.com, and I have all kinds of things posted, some videos, description of the book. We also have surveys that we continuously do and experiment, so we're always happy to get people to participate in those as well.
Yeah, I want to encourage all our viewers to check that out, and to our viewers out there, I really appreciate you all for watching. And if you learned anything during this episode, I encourage you to go on iTunes. The link's on the right side of the video and write us a review. This way you can help me out, but also help others find this video. So, Dan,
Tell them to do it now, right?
Do it now.
General action plan doesn't work as well. Do it now.
Do it now. Pause this video.
That's right.
Do it now. Okay, now you're unpausing the video. You just did it. Thank you. Dan, this has been great. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.